Ready to proceed?
May it please the Court, Kevin Howard here for the appellant, Mr. McDonald. Mr. Chief Justice, this is a one-issue appeal of the trial court's denial of the defendant's motion to suppress evidence prior to trial. By way of factual background, this is a car stop case. Mr. McDonald was a passenger in a motor vehicle that was parked at a shortstop parking lot in Canterbury, south of Dover here. The driver's role in this particular matter is not of much import, but in any event, a police officer patrolled through the parking lot. Corporal Hake, who works for the governor's task force doing street-level drug interdiction, as he rolled through the parking lot, he saw the car lawfully parked, a passenger and a driver, and a pedestrian standing nearby. Wasn't much record or recollection on the officer's part of the level of interaction between these people. In any event, as is their custom, he ran the tag, according to him, as he drove by. And in running the tag, he claimed that the tag came back as fictitious. As the officer drove by, he parked at the northern end of the parking lot, which it's a very small parking lot. I think he testified it's well under 300 feet in length. The car in question backed up, began to leave the parking lot. And the officer claims that at that point, he double-checked his work. He looked down at his computer screen, and he looked at the car tag, and he saw that the numbers were identical to the numbers he entered, and the tag was coming up fictitious.
So he didn't enter it again. He just looked at the screen again.
That's correct. He didn't enter it again. He just looked at his screen, saw the numbers that he had typed in, confirmed that those were the numbers on the tag that went by, according to him, drove by. Of course, like you could tell from my brief that I don't know.
Well, you keep saying according to him, but so the trial judge found, right?
Well, I think what the trial judge found was that he made a mistake. That's what the court found, that he made a mistake.
But when you use the phrase according to him, you're suggesting to us that there's some credibility issue. But the trial judge resolved that in favor of the police officer, didn't he?
Well, I don't think he resolved the credibility issue. What he said was the mistake was unimportant.
Okay.
That'll be important from the purpose of my argument in a moment. In any event, the car...
Well, before we leave the tag, later, the officer was able to put in the correct number and ascertain that the vehicle was properly registered.
That's correct, Your Honor. At all times relevant to anything involving this case, the car was a lawfully registered Delaware motor vehicle. The police officer then continued to observe the car. The car reached the threshold of the parking lot, turned right. Didn't use a turn signal. This particular police officer decided that the Delaware turn signal law applied to cars exiting parking lots. Frankly, according to his theory, you would never be able to exit that parking lot because it's not 300 feet in length. In any event, fortunately for us, the General Assembly doesn't include parking lots such as that in the turn signal statute requirement.
Nor does it in driving an unregistered motor vehicle. I checked.
Very good, Your Honor. Although that motor vehicle did end up being operated on a highway or a roadway shortly after it exited the parking lot. So in that sense, I guess technically the state could point to that as a motor vehicle violation. In any event, so you have what I've generously described in my brief as a blunder on the police officer's part, compounded by yet a second blunder when he examined the tag, and a misapplication of Delaware motor vehicle law to the factual circumstances. Now, frankly, when we started the hearing at the trial court level, I thought those were the issues. The trial court judge decided to expand the inquiry to determine whether there were other, I presume, objective facts that may have been interpreted by this police officer and incorporated in his thinking process. In a refreshing note of candor, this police officer indicated that none of those factors had anything to do with why he stopped the car, although they are what the trial court relied on in its opinion.
Why did the police officer stop the car?
He stopped the car, according to his affidavit of probable cause, for a turn signal violation.
He later notwithstanding the registration, he wasn't going to approach the car or do anything, and apparently didn't. Is that correct?
That's correct. He did not initially activate emergency equipment when he initially gleaned a registration violation. He continued to observe
the vehicle. So he stopped the car and was going to give them a ticket for the turn signal violation.
Presumably he would have determined that he, again, giving him the benefit of the doubt, that he made a mistake when he inputted the numbers, and he would not have done anything in connection with the registration violation, because there wasn't a registration violation.
Does the record reflect how people on the task force divide their time between traffic violations and investigating suspicious activity that may be related to drugs? Is it typical, for example, for the people on the governor's task force to be involved in enforcing the motor vehicle laws?
Your Honor, I could speak for 2 hours on that subject, but there's not much of a record here. In point of fact, the governor's task force has made an art out of arresting people for flashlight violations in the Woodside area just so they can search their pockets. They routinely
enlighten the court. What's a flashlight violation?
Well, walking along the roadway in a neighborhood without your flashlight. In fact, if you ride down to Woodside now, you'll see a whole array of black teenagers carrying flashlights so they don't get detained and searched. The governor's task force applies a hyper sensitivity to motor vehicle violations. I think that that's as generous as I can be under the circumstances, stopping motor vehicles for any number of technical violations that they would never otherwise consider. They don't write traffic tickets. They do street-level drug interdiction, and their goal is to search your car and your person, and they use traffic stops to gain access to your pockets. And in this particular case, what developed is a passenger got arrested, not a driver for a
motor. How would you characterize the Superior Court's ruling? As you said, in looking at the record, it appears that the Superior Court took a lot of things into consideration, including the interaction between the car and the pedestrians, notwithstanding the fact that the officer said he only stopped the car for the turn signal violation.
Well, I think where the trial court missed the mark there is that the second part of that analysis, if there are objective facts out there that contribute to the totality of the circumstances, then you have to examine how the police officer subjectively interprets them. Well, here, he didn't interpret any of them. He didn't care about them. They never factored into his thinking. So the trial court missed the mark in using that particular application of the law. If this police officer would have testified from questioning that, in addition to these other factors, this is at night, it's in a drug area, I've investigated there before, I see a black man standing next to a car, a black man passenger, a Hispanic driver, they leave shortly after I arrive, his spider senses were not tingling about any of that, and he candidly admitted that. It's much easier, and you all have heard, I'm sure, so many of these cases at this point you're aware, for them just to nitpick a technical motor vehicle violation to start the process of the search. And that's what they routinely do. And this case is no different. And what I'm asking the court to do is put its foot down and say, wait a minute, we're not going to let you manufacture reasonable suspicion by sloppy police work. If the court allows this particular stop to stand, what's to prevent all of them from simply saying, oh, I punched in the registration numbers and had it transposed, came back to a Volkswagen, this is a Vega, so I stopped the car?
What I'm having some difficulty understanding is, what's our standard of review? It's clear that what the trial judge did was analyze the facts, at least from his perspective, on the basis of whether or not they supported a reasonable articulable suspicion on the part of the police officer that a crime was being committed that would justify the stop and whatever natural further investigation that may flow from that, which in this case, if I remember the facts correctly, included, amazingly, drugs in plain view on the seat of the car or something along those lines. When you determine whether there's reasonable articulable suspicion, you look at the totality of the circumstances. Are you suggesting that the totality of the circumstances that the trial judge examines is limited to the articulated reasons that the police officer gives and those only at the hearing?
Well, I think the law is in looking at Flannery, I think is the case, you can look at the totality of the circumstances, but the second part of that is how are they subjectively interpreted by the police officer? That's the second part of the inquiry. And in this case, there wasn't any subjective interpretation of any of these other factors.
Well,
by this police
officer.
He was
in the parking lot at that hour because that was an area that was a known spot for drug transactions. That's in the record, isn't it?
I think what's in the record is he was on parole or patrol. Excuse me, Freudian slip. He was on patrol, and that included driving through that parking lot. Presumably, he patrols, if he's a governor's task force officer, any area where there may be drug crimes.
Okay. Well, the trial judge would have an understanding of why the police officer happened to be there at that spot at that hour, and that would factor in the totality of the circumstances.
And his interpretation of all of those events that he witnessed in the parking lot was that he did not see any unlawful conduct on the part of anyone, that he merely noticed these people standing there. That's what the police officer's subjective interpretation.
So the police officer's first thought that there might be unlawful conduct other than there are two people in a car and a passenger and a pedestrian nearby in an area known for drug sales was when he, under whatever circumstances you choose to believe, and we know what the trial judge believed, he made a mistake in the entry of the license tag and determined based on the computer response that it was a fictitious tag or an unregistered motor vehicle. That was his first indication there was any kind of unlawful activity at all, correct?
I agree.
And that didn't relate to the parking lot because it isn't a crime to drive an unregistered motor vehicle in a parking lot. But then he focuses entirely on 4155B and concludes erroneously that the motor vehicle offense for which he will stop the driver is failing to give a turn signal while entering the roadway. Then he double checks the registration and finds out, oops, it isn't an unregistered motor vehicle. Now, what are the totality of the circumstances that the record supports for the stop at this point?
There are none. There are simply none. Unless the court wants to decide that a cop can make a series of mistakes.
Well, where does the trial judge come up with the phrase unprovoked flight?
I have no idea, Judge. I mean, I have unprovoked flight from the 7-Eleven every time I get a cup of coffee when I'm done there. And, in fact, what the judge said, I quoted him. Let me go to my special equipment. I made a note. He said, I think under some circumstances you could construe as someone going about their business. Those are the other words he used for the unprovoked flight. And then he related it to the context of the area, driver, passenger, pedestrian situation, and presumed invalid registration. That was sort of the series of things he said. But
is there anything in the record that suggests, for example, that the police officer saw the driver turn, furtively look at the police car, and then drive away?
No. In fact, I asked him about that. There wasn't any eye contact, no suspicious activity. He didn't know how long they had been there or anything else. There's no indication and nothing in the record to indicate that there was any even recognition that a police officer had pulled into the parking lot. They weren't backed in. They were parked head in, according to the police officer. He drove behind them in an unmarked vehicle, parked at the north end of the parking lot. That was it. So to call it unprovoked flight, I mean, it adds a certain element of danger to the scenario, but, you know, if it was, it's more likely, or the characterization is probably truth to be stated, that it's simply a couple people who've done their business.
Let's go back to my original question. How do we review this? If it's correct as a matter of law that the analysis was based on whether or not there existed a reasonable articulable suspicion to stop and further the investigation.
Judge,
the facts that are developed for the totality of the circumstances are reviewable, let's say, on an abuse of discretion basis. How do we review the combination of the two here to reach a conclusion?
Well, the formulation and application of the legal concepts here. I think it's generally a de novo review. I mean, how the judge formulated and applied the law here. Now, these facts, I would suggest, despite my rancor, that they could be characterized as undisputed. If the judge found as a matter of credibility that the police officer made those two mistakes in running the registration, so he didn't find bad faith on the part of the police officer. But the balance of the factual findings would be reviewable to determine whether there's evidence to support the conclusions of the judge, the conclusions and the findings that he reached. I think that's how this has to be reviewed, in the broadest sense.
You don't find any constitutional or legal prohibition of the police officer sitting back in the parking lot, waiting until the vehicle gets on the roadway, having known in advance in his own mind that it was an unregistered motor vehicle. No problem waiting for it to go on the roadway. So there was at least superficially, driving an unregistered motor vehicle on the highway at that point.
Judge, it bothers me, but you know, an analogous circumstance would be, and it happens every day, where police officers sit outside of tavern areas or bars and they wait till people get in their cars and drive off.
Well, I'm looking at your motion to suppress, which is B2 in the state's appendix. And as I understand it, the registration was not in the affidavit of probable cause. So the police officer's position in the affidavit is exclusively based on the turn signal.
That's absolutely true, Judge. And, you know, I made this argument at the trial court, and I still believe it. I think when the police officer got to the station, he figured out that he didn't have a turn signal violation. So he had to come up with some other reason. And that information about erroneously entering the registration doesn't show up until he's writing his report hours later. And now the trial court heard that argument and didn't buy it. But the affidavit of probable cause, which was the first thing that he wrote when he got back to the station to get arrest warrants, only recites the turn signal violation as the reason for the stop. It doesn't mention anything about a suspicious high drug area, seeing a pedestrian near a car, any of that stuff. Never occurred to him.
So then, to go back to the Chief Justice's question, our focus is, was there a reasonable, articulable basis for concluding there was a turn signal violation? And if there was, then if the drugs were discovered in plain view, it all comes into evidence. But if no reasonable person could conclude there was a turn signal violation coming out of the parking lot, then there was no basis for the stop.
That's true, Judge, except that the record includes this bit about the registration and the mistake of the police officer. I don't know how the court gets by at least dealing with that. And my suggestion is that in other cases, in the Jones case, I guess the court held that just because somebody runs from a police officer after an illegal seizure, they can't use that to manufacture a suspicion any more than they should be allowed to make a series of mistakes and then use that to claim that it provides the reasonable suspicion. In the case that the state cited about the issue where the police officer got information from motor vehicle and that information was wrong, but he relied on it in good faith, it's a totally different circumstance. This is a road trooper making the mistake. And if the court rules in the state's favor, it's an open invitation for these guys to ratchet up the conduct, which I believe is already reprehensible.
You want to save your last minute?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Berger. May it please the court.
But before you get into your argument, I would like to try and clarify where the record stands. I understand that the affidavit doesn't make reference to invalid registration, right?
That's correct, yes.
And I have to assume that's because by that time he realized that it was a valid registration. But be that as it may, am I correct that the record establishes that one of the reasons for pulling this car over was that at the time the police officer believed that it was a car that was invalidly, that lacked registration?
Well, I think it's probably that and the turn signal violation.
Right, but let's forget about the turn signal for a second. Is there record support for the trial court concluding that the registration issue was one of the reasons for stopping the car?
Yes, I think initially in Corporal Hake's testimony, he talks about that, that he pulls into the parking lot, sees the vehicle, runs the tag number, and was incorrect.
This is kind of a little bit finer point here. We know that while he's sitting in the parking lot, he runs the numbers and gets back a report saying that this is an invalid tag. Okay?
Right.
My question is not whether he did that before he stopped the car, but whether his belief that it was an invalid tag was a reason for ultimately stopping the car. Is there evidence of that?
Well, I think there probably is. It's probably more inferential because when he takes the two individuals to Troop 3, he runs the tag again. So I'm assuming the police officer has this continuing belief that it's an unregistered vehicle until he's back to the state police troop and runs the tag a second time. So I think in his process, his thought process, that was a continuing impression he had till he ran it a second time and realized that, oh, no, I made a mistake. It is a registered vehicle.
Did he testify to what he told the driver was the reason or the reasons that he stopped him?
I don't think he did. The testimony, I believe it's at A11 about the actual stop of the appendix.
I had the impression, perhaps my recollection of record is not good, but I had the impression that the police officer was asked on the record for his reasons, and in addition to his affidavit, his stated reason was the 4155 violation and not invalid registration.
Yes, I think that's correct. And I think what the officer...
Now, is that consistent with an inference that stopping him because of an unregistered motor vehicle, an invalid tag, a fictitious tag, whatever you want to call it, was indeed on his mind as a reason when he stopped him or not?
Well, I think he certainly was in his thought processes.
I mean, even when he answered the question, no, my reason was the 4155B violation?
Oh, no, I think that's different. I think by then he's already run the tag. It's a difference between what happened.
I'm not making myself clear. At the hearing, was he asked, what was your reason for stopping the vehicle? And did he or did he not reply that my reason was the turn signal violation?
Yes.
Period.
Let's say 11, yes. That's correct. And that's what he says. He says at the top of the page there, they continued north. The vehicle approached the intersection of Irish Hill Road. There was no turn signal indicator on. Made a right turn onto Irish Hill Road. You can travel eastbound. He says, it was at that point in time that I pulled out, activated my emergency equipment and stopped the vehicle. So I think it's after he views what he considers to be a turn signal violation.
And at the time that car pulled onto the road, if part of his thought process had been that the operator was driving an unregistered motor vehicle, he would have answered the question by saying he pulled onto the roadway of the state of Delaware in an unregistered motor vehicle and failed to give a turn signal.
I think that's correct.
If a fair inference was that invalid registration was on his mind at all at that point.
Well, I don't know if it was on his mind at all. I mean, I assume
told us it was. It was part of his thought processes. I'm trying to figure out how the record supports that inference.
I'm having some trouble with that. Well, I think it's because the prior testimony of the officer was that when he first pulls into the parking lot of this Shore Stop at night, he sees the vehicle there, and he runs the tag number, and that's when it comes up.
You know, I understand that, but when he's asked specifically, in effect, why did you pull the car over, no part of his answer includes an unregistered motor vehicle.
That's correct. And it's sufficient to do a stop and to have reasonable articulable suspicion for a violation of the law. And the legal question here, I guess, is whether or not this was a turn signal violation or not. The Indiana court, interpreting a somewhat similar statute, says that in this parking lot scenario where you're on private property where the normal highway motor vehicle laws don't apply, but you pull out onto a regular regulated highway, that is a violation, even though you wouldn't physically be able to give the turn signal long enough because of the length or width of the parking lot.
They have a similar statute that says Title 21 violations, with the exception of DUI and reckless driving, must be on the highway or roadway of the state of Delaware?
No, I don't think they have anything like that.
That controls this statute, doesn't it?
Well, I the state takes issue with that. I think the way you interpret 4101 and the definition of highways is that if your conduct is completely in the parking lot, and there was an old Superior Court case that then-Judge Christie decided where someone was apprehended for driving under the influence in an AMP parking lot. Presumably all the conduct occurred on private property so that it wouldn't apply, but there is exceptions where they extract out of that general non-application certain provisions, one of which is the DUI provision. The argument in that case was whether it was a general or specific statute. But I think the point of all this is that if all the conduct is strictly on private property, then yes, 4101 and the general highway definition at the beginning of Title 21 applies. But once you leave...
Well, if you waited to give the turn signal until you were actually on the highway, it wouldn't make much sense, would it? The turn signal was given before, if there were one to be given,
right,
it would have been given before you entered the roadway.
Yes, but you have to also enter the roadway. I mean, that's when you've actually committed the offense, is when you're on the roadway. But, you know, everything happens one step after the other. And I think the way to interpret this is, yes, if all he had done was just drive around the parking lot, then he couldn't have been charged.
Well, for whatever the significance, do you agree that it's not unlawful in Delaware to operate an unregistered motor vehicle on private property?
I think that's true, yes. I mean, you don't have to have a tag. If you're just driving your farm vehicle on your farm, you don't have to have the tag. I think you only need the farm tag is if you're moving it out onto the highway from one location of the farm property to the other. But
do you agree, then, that the exclusive focus in this case would be on the turn signal violation?
Well, that was the reason given for stopping the vehicle, yes, and that's what the affidavit of probable cause.
If we focus on the governor's task force, and we go back to Mr. Howard's argument that they vigorously enforce the traffic laws, and sometimes it results in valid arrests, not only for the traffic violation, but for drug-related offenses. And let's assume that's entirely proper. His argument in this case is, this was not a close question on the turn signal violation, and this is not vigorous enforcement of the motor vehicle laws. It's really an inappropriate stretch that resulted in evidence that was in plain view but should have never been seen because the car never had been stopped, should have been stopped. How does that factor into the equation? You know, it doesn't mean that the police have to be correct all the time about motor vehicle violations, but why is this a close case?
Well, I don't know if it is a close case. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious there was a turn signal violation here, and I think that's what the Indiana Court of Appeals said in a pretty similar factual situation with a pretty similar statute. And the law is clear. I think the more recent Superior Court decision in Corsi says, you know, if you have a violation of the law, of course you can stop them, and that's reasonable articulable suspicion. So I think that's the case. The assertion, I guess, that's being made, although it's not articulated as such, is that this is a pretextual stop. But the U.S. Supreme Court that's ruled on it says, well, you know, stopping motor vehicles for motor vehicle violations, even if it is a pretext to then search the vehicle or the occupants, is not constitutionally objectionable. I
mean, that's dependent on an actual violation, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. You know, it has to be an actual violation of the law, and that's the issue.
I want to get back to the the registration issue. At page B8, there is some discussion by the officer about what he did when he went back to the troop, where he ran the numbers again because he thought it might have been a stolen vehicle, since it had come back as, since at the scene when he had punched in the wrong numbers, it had come back as being an unregistered vehicle or a fictitious vehicle, yes, whatever it was. So then he goes to the troop and ran the VIN to see if the vehicle was stolen. This is his statement: because I had run the VIN at the troop to see if the vehicle was stolen, since it came up as unregistered at the traffic stop. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In that discussion, the officer says that he had removed the tag, the license plate, from the motor vehicle and had it with me, since I had seized that as evidence.
Yes.
Isn't it a fair inference from that statement that at least until he did his double check and found out that he had made a mistake, again, assuming we're believing him, that when he pulled the car over, he was operating at least in part on the basis of a belief that it was not a registered vehicle?
I think that's true, yes.
So earlier you were conceding that the only basis for stopping the vehicle was the turn signal violation. And I'm asking you whether this isn't evidence to support a finding that the trial court made, that he believed that he was pulling the car over also because of a tag violation.
Well, that may be. And, I mean, I think you can draw a number of inferences. What the officer says at A11 is he doesn't activate his emergency equipment and initiate a stop till he sees what he thinks is a turn signal violation. You know, he doesn't stop the vehicle simply because he thinks it's an unregistered vehicle. He waits until the vehicle is pulled out onto this adjoining roadway, and there's no turn signal. Then he says he activates his emergency equipment, and that's when the stop occurs. You know, exactly what all the sequence is a little hard to say. I mean, these were things that were certainly on his mind, as well as the other factors that the trial court pointed to: the particular location, the time of night. It was about quarter after midnight when this occurred, and the officer said from his experience that this was an area where drug transactions did take place at night, illegal drug transactions. And he also mentioned that the store itself had been robbed several times. So those were all factors that I guess he had in mind. He doesn't articulate those as being the reason for the stop, though. He's just, when he's asked by the trial judge about that, he says that, you know, this is what he knew about the area. So I think viewing the totality of the circumstances, those are factors. The unprovoked flight, I think that comes from the fact, and this is, again, reasoning inferentially, the fact that the vehicle left shortly after the trooper arrived and did not signal when it turned out onto the roadway. I think that's probably the only real factual basis for assuming any type of flight. And the judge indicates that flight alone isn't sufficient, and I think that's an accurate statement of the law, but it's one of the, or unprovoked flight, it's one of the additional factors that you can consider in a totality of the circumstances test, however.
Doesn't the use of the word flight necessarily imply that there's some objective evidence that the driver and or passenger, or for that matter, the pedestrian nearby, told the driver or passenger that there was a police officer from whom they should flee? I mean, is anyone who leaves a shortstop parking lot without giving a turn signal fleeing unprovokedly from the shortstop parking lot with their skim milk and ice cream bar?
Well, if it's hot, you may want to get the ice cream out of there. But I think that is the only evidence.
It's certainly a little hyperbolic.
Well, that may be, and that's just one of the factors. And I think the only really objective evidence in what we're doing here is looking to see if there is competent evidence in the record to support the trial judge's factual
findings. You agree that there's nothing in the record that objectively demonstrates that the driver and or passenger in the automobile knew that the police officer was in an unmarked car in the parking lot?
Oh, I don't think there's any evidence that suggests that. I mean, there wasn't any testimony that, you know, people were pointing or heads were turning.
No one shouted 5-0 if we've become accustomed to hearing in 9 out of 10 cases.
No, we didn't have any of that. It looks like it's just a car pulled in front of the Shore Stop. There's two occupants in the car in the front seats. There's a third individual standing outside the car, and the police officer pulls in behind and drives, I think, over to the side and turns around or makes some maneuver. And as he's going by, I guess he sees the tag, and that's when he punches the tag in, and apparently erroneously punches the tag in because it comes up initially as an unregistered vehicle.
What's, in your view, Mr. Williams, you know as much about these cases as anyone I know, what would you suggest to us as our standard of review? How do we put together the factual findings concerning the totality of the circumstances and address how or if they're properly applied to the legal standard of reasonable articulable suspicion? What's your recommendation to us on how to handle that?
Well, when you get into these things, it's kind of mixed standards, and depending on what you're focusing on, it's a different standard. The general standard for denial of suppression motions after an evidentiary hearing is abuse of discretion. Now, included in that, there's some legal issues that have to be resolved, and the standard of review for that is de novo. Did the judge properly interpret and formulate the legal principles that applied? And if he did that incorrectly, then that's simply a question of law, and this court reviews those de novo. As to the factual findings that the judge may have made as part of his complete reasoning, those are upheld as long as they are supported by competent evidence in the record and they're not clearly erroneous. And part of the clearly erroneous determination involves an examination of the reasoning processes. Is it a logical, deductive reasoning process? And if the trial judge does all that and his factual findings are based on competent evidence and he didn't misapply the law, then it's normally upheld and viewed under a simple abuse of discretion standard. But depending on which of the particular factors you're looking at, there is a different standard of review or scope of review involved in those matters. It gets a little confusing because behind all this, if there's a constitutional claim, which, you know, is normally what's involved at the root of all this, then that's generally a question of law, and that's de novo review as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those. All right. Thank you.
I just want to touch on one aspect of the case concerning the factual finding about this registration and this mistake. I think there is room for the court to conclude that the record does not support the trial court's finding that a simple mistake occurred here with the registration. The registration was checked by this police officer who testified that he typed the numbers into his computer, looked at the numbers, compared them to the tag. That's the first time. That's according to him. And then moments later, examined the tag again and confirmed it was the number that he had typed into his computer. Well, I don't think you can find that to be credible under the circumstances. It doesn't smack of a mistake. If it does, then it's a mistake made 2.5 minutes under and supposedly with a trained police officer. So in terms of the review of this case, if it gets to the point where there's a technical evaluation of the registration issue, there are not facts to support a conclusion that the police officer simply made a mistake. And the court was clearly erroneous in making any finding that might have suggested that.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.